From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
On the panel this week, Laura Meckler, staff writer for The Wall Street Journal, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to The National Journal. Our moderator is the White House correspondent for West Wing Reports, Paul Brandis.
Hello, and here are the issues. President Donald Trump has now been in office for a year, and what a year it has been. One of the most contentious issues, immigration, continues to dominate the headlines. The Central Intelligence Agency, or CIA, has captured a suspected mole, the humankind, that is, and the Winter Olympics are bringing North and South Korea closer. Let's start with President Trump. Boy, time flies, a whole year in office. We could talk about this president all day long. In fact, we've been talking about him for a whole year, I think. But let's try and boil it down. Tough to do. Donald Trump, 1 year. Go.
Well, it's been intense, to put it mildly. He's had some successes. He's had some failures. All that you can say empirically, I think, is that he ends his first year in office with the lowest public approval ratings of any president in history since there has been polling at this point in his tenure.
And it's not even by a little bit. It's by a wide margin.
It's not even close. So what it says to me is that, like his two predecessors, President Trump is a polarizing president. And it remains to be seen where we go from here. There's a lot of contentiousness. There's a lot of polarization. And his defenders, of course, say he has begun the arduous process of draining the swamp. If that's correct, he's got a ways to go.
Or Meckler, Tom was talking about how unpopular Trump is in the polls, if you aggregate them all together, lowest since the post-World War II era. And yet his base loves him. He's doing everything that his base loves. So what do you read into that?
Well, there's a huge divide in this country is what I read into that. So basically what you have, and he reflects it, he revels in it. He does things that a lot of people look at and say, this is outrageous. This is offensive. This is upsetting. This is unproductive. And people who root for him say, great, he's saying what I think. He's not being worrying about being politically correct. So I think that you have this really fundamental divide. And as long as that exists, Donald Trump will continue to be able to govern the way he has, which is truly like a chaos theory. I mean, the most remarkable thing to me about this year, though, is that how many days there have been when I have said and all of us have said, like, I can't believe that happened. I can't believe he tweeted that or he said that or this thing came to be. I mean,
almost every day.
Almost every single day. You know, just this week, we had a situation where he put a tweet out that directly undermined his own party's strategy for passing a government funding bill. Now, that's the kind of thing that will be, you know, long forgotten, you know, maybe by tomorrow. But yet, it's in any other world, that would be a huge story for any other president, to undermine your own party's legislative strategy. So there's just been time and time again examples of these sorts of things. And then along the way, we have his policies being invalidated by the Supreme Court, him putting someone onto the Supreme Court, utterly failing on health care, utterly succeeding on taxes. There's just been, and it's been an enormous year.
You want to add to that, Tom?
Just that I have covered now 10 presidents, beginning in the last months of President Lyndon B. Johnson. And I have never covered a president who has surrounded himself with such chaos as President Trump. That doesn't mean he's dead in the water politically, but I mean it has been a lot of crockery broken in the first year of Trump, for better or worse, and it remains to be seen which it is.
A lot of it, just before we move on, I mean, a lot of people are just beyond the chaos and the drama that we see every day. People are concerned about much more serious and fundamental issues, attacks on things that we've always cherished and taken for granted, like the free press, for example. It's those things that people find particularly alarming. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think absolutely that's true. I mean, when you look at what's happened with the press, I mean, he is trying day in and day out to undermine the idea that you can trust what the press tells you. So from the very beginning, so, I mean, if we look back to over a year ago, right soon after his election, you know, news was coming out about the fact that there had been these fabricated stories in that had been spread during the election. Now, literally fabricated. I'm talking about people, someone sitting in their pajamas in a living room somewhere in Europe making something up to try to make money through clicks on Facebook. That was dubbed fake news. And the president took that term and made it his own and decided to apply it to mainstream news that he didn't like or that maybe had changed or things that were in, but within the realm of normal reporting, he was using that term. And he used it over and over and over again. And the idea, the goal, is to try to undermine American confidence in the news. Like, what do you, you know, who are you going to believe? The newspaper, that fake news newspaper, or me? And I think that that is dangerous. I don't think that the country is going under. I think that we have a very strong free press in this country. And I think we have a lot, you know, the vast majority of Americans believe in it. But he is chipping away at that, or trying to.
And one finally, one other issue about this, since this is a global radio program, people are listening in all corners of the world. There's a lot of concern and questions about sort of America's role in the world now. The world has traditionally looked to the United States for leadership to set an example. What has changed in the past year, in your view, Tom, quickly?
Well, I think it's fair to say that many of our longtime allies, especially in Europe, worry about American resolve. And they worry that China especially and Russia have sensed a vacuum in American leadership and are moving very aggressively around the world to exploit that. We'll see how that turns out. But it's fair to say that relations between traditional American allies are a little rocky right now.
And it's fair to say that the polling of global nations shows that confidence in America, let's be honest here, is down sharply over the past year.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that one of his goals is to instill confidence around the world in America necessarily. I mean, that he's a very sort of America first. That's what his inauguration speech was about. And he would say that they don't have confidence in us. That's because we're not kowtowing to them, I suspect.
So. Okay. And moving on, one big issue in this country, obviously something we've been talking about all year. It's going to be in the news all 2018, certainly, is immigration. The United States has always welcomed and, in fact, has taken great pride in the fact that we've welcomed people from other countries. That philosophy seems to be under attack now, particularly with what are called Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or a shorter term for that is DACA. It's about 700,000 people who came to this country as children in years past without proper documentation. They're also called Dreamers. There are some people in the Trump administration who perhaps want to send these people home. Their status is now in jeopardy. It's a huge political dispute. Laura, what's going on here?
Well, I actually think that the general view in the Trump administration is that they're okay with the Dreamers staying in the U.S. and that they didn't like the program that President Obama put in place, which essentially used executive authority to give a de facto legal status to people who were in the country illegally. Didn't like that program, ended that program. That DACA program is on its way out. The question is, will it be replaced legislatively? I think the administration is fine with a legislative fix, as they would say. The question is, they want a big trade-off for it. So there's an irony in their position. They're like, we'd like you to do this, but only if you give us these, you know, sometimes as long as 75 things that we want. So that's the question right now, is what will the trade-off be? What kind of, and those trade-offs involve tougher enforcement, cuts to legal immigration, a border, money for a border wall on the southwest border with Mexico, and changes to how we deal with people who arrive in the country illegally. So it's a very, very messy debate, and it has to do with at its heart, you know, how much do you really need to get into this agreement in order to gain enough support to push it through Congress.
And you mentioned the border wall, Laura, obviously one of President Trump's signature issues. He talked about it all the time during his campaign. He still insists that we're going to have it. He still seems to think that Mexico somehow is going to pay for this, his signature issue. What is the status of this, Tom?
Well, I mean, it's still up in the air. President Trump is holding out for exactly the terms that you've just described, although his chief of staff, retired General John Kelly, has suggested that it's a bit of a stretch. Those are not his words exactly, but it's not likely that Mexico is going to pay for to build a border wall. That would be politically unpopular, to put it mildly, with Mexican voters. But the status is, it's caught up in this larger debate about what you do about the Dreamers, the DACA 700,000, and domestic.
It's all tied together, as you say.
Exactly right. Yeah. I mean, to a layman, it would make sense just to figure out a deal on DACA and just do it as a clean piece of legislation and be done with it. Because even President Trump at one point recently said, we need a DACA bill of love. But there are some people around him who hate the notion of anybody being in this country illegally. And President Trump got walked back by somebody, I suspect one of his senior White House domestic advisors, who is an immigration hawk, to put it mildly. So it's the status is it's still up in the air, and it's caught up in this other issue of, is the government going to get shut down, which we'll get to, I'm sure, soon. And I mean, I think the Dreamers ultimately will be allowed to stay. But when and under what procedures and how that sorts out very much is up in the air.
And talk about this, a bill of love, notwithstanding, Laura, the president has made some very unloving comments in the past week, using some derogatory language that we can't use here about immigrants from certain parts of the world. Does that reflect sort of his really deeply held views on immigration, or is that just sort of a, you know, one of his usual slip of the tongues?
Well, it seems like he definitely has some hostility towards immigrants from the third world. I mean, there's, you know, he has, it's not the first time there have been reports of those, that kind of language in private that he's used. I think that he is very quick to brush off large numbers of people, in this case, the entire continent of Africa, disparaging it, as well as people from Haiti. That was all triggered. And you know, our listeners may be interested in this. There's this diversity visa lottery, which exists right now, which gives people a chance for a green card if you're from a country that doesn't have a lot of immigration to the U.S. And a lot of Africans, that's the path they use to get here. He hates this thing because it's not based on merit. Yeah. You don't get it because you could have something particular to contribute. You don't even get it because you have a family tie. You just win a lottery. So that was the context of the discussion. His argument is, and he puts it much rougher than most people do, but there are other people who would make the same argument, which is that if we have a limited ability to accept immigrants, we can only take in so many. And if that's the case, we should pick people who are, you know, have high skills. So,
all right.
That's the argument.
I'm going to have to stop it right there. We're going to be talking about this, I'm sure, all year long. We'll take a quick break here. More issues in the news in just a moment.
This program is coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. And a reminder that Issues in the News is available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. And don't forget to like us on Facebook, Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Laura Meckler, staff writer for The Wall Street Journal, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to The National Journal. Our moderator is Paul Brandis, the White House correspondent for West Wing Reports.
Welcome back. Espionage is called the world's second oldest profession. Every government spies on every other government. The United States just arrested a former CIA officer, and they've charged him with illegal possession of classified information. But the government thinks he actually might be responsible for something much worse than that, passing information on to China that the U.S. thinks enabled Beijing to roll up, in other words, shut down an American spy network in China. It's being called a huge catastrophe. How big of a deal is this?
Well, I think it's a pretty big deal. I mean, when we're talking about the dismantling of the U.S. Spy network in China, I think it was 18 or 20 different agents we had working in China were either killed or jailed, and a huge setback for our ability to know what's going on in that country. So I think that it's a pretty big deal. And the fact that he might have been involved in that piece of it and not just a single one-off is what makes it, I think, a much bigger story. So, you know, we'll see more information will come out as this case is pursued. But so far, from the looks of it, it looks like it's a fairly major case.
Tom?
I think another big component of this is that whatever else this is or isn't, it's pretty clear that the Chinese have critical information about how the United States government contacts and stays in touch, the technological and electronic procedures by which we make contact and remain in contact with operatives overseas. They apparently have cracked a code. And the U.S. government believes that this former employee allegedly was behind the Chinese cracking this code. But he's only been charged with having the names of CIA agents and operatives, which is illegal after you leave the government. But it is not clear whether a case can be made that he actually passed this information on to the Chinese government. Maybe that case will be made, maybe it won't. But I agree with Laura, this is a huge deal. It gives China a real leg up on intelligence, protecting their own and knowing a lot more about how U.S. intelligence does its business overseas. This is a very big deal, and it's been going on under the radar for 4 or 5 years. And I wouldn't say it's catastrophic, but some within the agency would use that term.
Well, some have, in fact, used
that
term. You know, it's important to remember that a lot of intelligence gathering is, and you alluded to this, is done electronically through, you know, tapping telephones or computer systems and that kind of thing. But in this case, we're talking about what's called a human intelligence, which is much harder. I mean, recruiting agents and developing them. This is a process that takes years and years and years. So to have this network shut down, it has been described as a catastrophe. Where would the U.S. go from here? I mean, we're still going to be spying on China as much as we can. How do you rebuild after something like this?
Honestly, I don't know. I assume it's just the hard work of, you know, recruiting new agents and, you know, slowly building a network back up. I have to believe it's possible, but I don't know exactly how it's done.
There's another very dangerous component to this in that published reports have said that it's not just that the American assets in China have been allegedly executed, but reports have said that many of these operatives have now been turned by the Chinese and now are working. Double agents, which of course requires the U.S. government to launch a massive counterintelligence operation to figure out whether the information they're getting from formerly valuable assets is now misinformation. So all the way around, this is a bad situation.
Well, that's why they call it the second oldest profession in the world. Finally this week, the Winter Olympics, every 4 years, well, they've rolled around again, and they start next month in South Korea. It's interesting, though, that athletes from North Korea are going to be marching with the South Korean athletes during the opening ceremony, marching under a unified flag. Very intriguing, and sort of the backdrop to all of this, of course, are these tensions between the United States and North Korea. Interesting timing here. What do you make of that? Is it a possible window to maybe diffuse tensions, Laura?
Yeah, you know, my first reaction when I heard this was, you know, for South Korea, which is located right there, you know, the idea of a hostility with North Korea is not just about, you know, global chess game and not just about, you know, who's up and who's down and what names people call each other, but like it's real. I mean, it's an existential threat. So they have a big interest in calming things down and trying to find a way out of this crisis. I'm not saying that we don't have an interest in that, but I think it's a little more real when you're in South Korea. So we see that, you know, this announcement was preceded by talks between the North and the South, where they did talk about the Olympics, but I think that there were other topics brought up as well. So, you know, here they are going to, you know, it's funny because over the decades, I mean, the Olympics has often had political overtones. Mm-hmm. All sorts of world affairs get played out under this banner of athletics. They're also going to be competing together on a women's ice hockey team, although evidently some of the women from the South Korean ice hockey team who thought they were skating and are no longer on the team, I think, are a little unhappy. But I think from the point of view of global affairs, it makes sense. And one more thought, which is that, you know, Donald Trump has just ratcheted up the tensions with the North Korea. And the folks in Hawaii were terrified when a alert was accidentally sent out last weekend to them saying that there was an incoming ballistic missile. People took that as a credible possibility. It turned out to be a mistake. But folks were like, this isn't outside of the realm of possibility. So we have that level of tension. And then on the other hand, you see North and South Korea, you know, competing together.
Why, Tom, are the North Koreans even doing this, in your view?
Well, because I think they think it's a way for them to put on their so-called, what they would say, their best face forward. They're going to have 230 cheerleaders and dancers and people who aren't competing, but they see this as a way to showcase cultural aspects of their culture. I do think the best thing about this is, let's hope. I believe it's very unlikely that Kim Jong-un was going to launch another missile test during the Olympics, now that he is engaged in having several hundred North Koreans come south of the border for the Olympics. But the tensions have not gone away. At the moment, at least, this is the first time anyone can remember. Actually, it is the first time that America's top three nuclear aircraft, the B-1, the B-2, and the B-52 bomber, which has been around longer than some of the crews who fly them, are all in Guam, are all in the theater of operations, where if a strike were ever launched, these aircraft would be deployed. And so that is I think that's a stick that the Trump administration is using to remind the North Koreans that we have assets and are prepared to use them. I don't think it's going to come to that, but you have all these countercurrents here going on in the Korean Peninsula.
There's also this sort of this kind of a carrot and stick thing going on with President Trump, too, Laura. I recall that when he spoke to the United Nations General Assembly last September, he threatened to, quote, totally destroy North Korea, just incendiary language as it gets. And yet he also says that he has a relationship with Kim Jong-un. It could be a good relationship, or it is, depending on sort of the tape recording of the conversation in which he said that. But he said that also he's willing to talk to Kim if the conditions were right. What might those conditions be? I mean, this might be kind of an interesting time to...
Who knows?
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, I don't know what the conditions would have to be for him to talk to him. I think that it's very hard to predict what President Trump is going to do on the world stage, or frankly, on the domestic stage as well. But, you know, whether he would actually have a conversation with him. I will say this for him. He doesn't, like some say, you know, the consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds. But, I mean, there's some truth to that in the sense that he doesn't really feel constrained by things he said in the past, which allows him to go forward. And if he sees an opportunity to make advances, he might in fact take it. I think that he won't be hemmed in by what has been past practice or even what he has said himself. And who knows, maybe that would lead to some sort of a positive breakthrough.
Tom, quickly on that one.
I don't think that's going to ever happen. Unless they sign a peace treaty, unless the U.S. and North Korea sign a peace treaty ending tensions forever, I don't think that's going to happen. And since I don't think that's going to happen, I don't think Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump are going to be getting together ever, But we will see.
And it's important to remember, by the way, that officially there is still a state of war in Korea. There was a truce signed in 1953, and that is it. So officially, we are still at, well, the U.S. and the U.N. are still at war on the Korean Peninsula. Interesting point that out. Now, that is all the time we have. Thanks to Laura Meckler, staff writer for The Wall Street Journal, Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to The National Journal. Great discussion, and thank you to both of you. This program was produced by VOA Current Affairs. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. And I'm Paul Brandis, White House correspondent for West Wing Reports. Thanks for listening.